May it please this honorable court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, I'm Roger Landon. I represent Christian Sekola, the appellant plaintiff below. I'm here today to urge the court to reverse, after conducting a de novo review of the proceedings below, to reverse the Superior Court's order entering judgment in favor of my client with a $5,000 credit for money previously paid by State Farm Insurance Company. This is an underinsured motorist dispute that was settled before trial last year in November of 2011. Delaware law favors voluntary settlement of litigated matters. And a settlement is treated as a contract for purposes of Delaware law and legal analysis. And the test of whether a contract has been formed is an objective one, not a subjective one, but an objective one. And to determine if a contract was formed, the party's manifestation of assent and not their subjective intent controls the result. A settlement agreement for $20,001 in new money was objectively reached in this case. And the briefing below and the briefing on appeal explains the course of conduct between the lawyers in the case as to how that objective settlement at $20,001 in new money occurred. And the way that it occurred essentially was this. Initially, there was an unsuccessful mediation procedure where State Farm came to the table with no money. They indicated that they wanted to have an independent medical exam performed. The case had been pending for 21 months in the Superior Court at that point. What we did was we adjourned the mediation process and allowed State Farm to go ahead and get its independent medical examination done, which it did. Dr. Gurr performed it. When Dr. Gurr wrote his report, he essentially confirmed the opinion set forth by the treating physician who was retained as an expert witness for the plaintiff, my client. We then went back to mediation. We didn't actually go back to mediation, but there was still mediator involvement. Yvonne Seville of the Weiss and Seville firm served as the mediator. And what happened at that point was Susan Housky, on behalf of State Farm, apparently communicated with Yvonne Seville and indicated to Yvonne that she had $15,000 in new money to offer to Mr. Sekola. Ms. Seville then communicated that offer to me by phone. I told Ms. Seville that $15,000 wouldn't do it. I asked her whether she thought there was any more money that State Farm had available, and she said she didn't know. I then contacted Susan Housky and said, I understand there's an offer of $15,000. That won't do it, but my client will accept $30,000. A few days later, I got a phone call from Susan Housky saying, all I have is $20,000. At that point, I believed, and I believe any reasonable person in my position would have reasonably believed, that that was an increase of the offer from the original $15,000 to $20,000. I told Ms. Housky at that point I didn't think that would do it, but I thought $25,000 might do it. I needed authority from my client. In the meantime, I talked to my client. He gave me authority to settle at $25,000. I communicated that to Ms. Housky. And the next thing that happened was I got an offer of judgment from Ms. Housky's office for $20,001. At that point, I thought, okay, all they have is $20,000 or $20,001. So she wasn't able to get any more authority.
Why was there a switch in the dialogue from communication about the mediation to an offer of judgment?
Why was there a switch in the dialogue? I don't know. I suspect, and what normally happens in these situations, and I've had any number of cases that have settled this way, and I do it from the defense standpoint because I represent defendants as well. Usually the offer of judgment is a way of signaling to the other side, we really mean it, this is as much as we have. And so I don't know, but I suspect that Ms. Housky was signaling to me that when I say $20,000, that's what I mean, $20,000, no more than that.
Is all of this in the record?
All of this is...
Other than the supposition about what the other counsel meant?
Well, some of this is in the record and some of it is not. What is in the record is the email communications between myself and Ms. Housky after the fact. The email communication of me accepting the $20,001 offer of judgment and the actual offer of judgment. So objectively, what is in the record is an agreement, first of all, an agreement by Ms. Housky that the initial offer was $15,000 and a $20,001 written offer of judgment, which was accepted. So those are the things that are in the record that were the record that was contemporaneously made.
Do you agree without the mediation process, just the advancement of the $5,000 and an offer of judgment of $20,001, that State Farm would have a credit of $5,000 against that?
No, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. What I do agree with is that if you look at the...
But didn't the language say that this will be essentially a credit against the damages?
What the language of the letter is, the letter that was sent on November 24 of 2009 with the advance payment of $5,000 says this amount will also be credited against any final determination of damages. What that means is, in the event that this case is not settled, and there's a trial, and there's a fact finder, a jury, or a judge who renders a verdict, because the jury would typically not be told of the $5,000 advance. So if there's a fact finder that renders a judgment against State Farm for whatever amount of money, then the $5,000 has to be credited against that amount so that State Farm isn't paying that money twice. But what happened here was a settlement. State Farm wants to term it as something other than a settlement, but it was nothing more than a settlement accomplished by way of an offer of judgment and an acceptance of that offer. And the settlement, objectively, was a settlement for new money of $20,001. And then the question is, well, somebody made a mistake here, and who made the mistake? And I will suggest to the court that if I were to go through this all over again, would I do things differently than I did? Yes. Did I make some mistakes? Yes. But in terms of the legal mistake that was made here and the legal analysis, if you have an objective situation, an objective contract made for $20,001, and then you look at where the mistake was made, the mistake was a unilateral mistake, we contend, by the defense, who offered $20,001 when the defense only had $15,001 to offer.
Can I ask you, use the term objective, what does that relate to when you say there's an objective contract for $20,001?
Well, it relates to the standard that the court has to apply in determining whether a contract was formed here, whether a contract which resulted in a settlement agreement was formed, and the court has to look at it from an objective point of view. There's an objective analysis. Objectively, was a contract formed, and if so, what were the terms of that contract from an objective standpoint? So looking at it, at the circumstances from a reasonably objective standard, was a contract formed, and if so, for what amount? Our argument is that a contract objectively was formed for $20,001.
Okay. You keep using the word objectively and without putting any concreteness on it. Is there something in the language of some document that says this is $20,001 of new money, or that this is without consideration of prior payments or something like that?
No, but there are two things here. There's the course of dealings between the lawyers that led up to the settlement amount, and then there's the actual document which says $20,001, period.
But it doesn't make any reference to whether that is the actual amount or $20,000, considering after 15,000 plus the 5,000 you already got.
Well, it's objectively, there's It's, you're absolutely correct. It's silent as to whether or not there's a credit.
Okay, so here's my overall problem.
Okay.
You seem to be saying that there was a contract made. The contract was for $20,000, $20,001, without reference to the five, so total $25,000. And the other side says, no, it was $20,000, including the five. And what's more, we knew from the get-go that we had a dispute as to whether that five is included or not, right? Would you agree that there's been an ongoing dispute as to whether that $5,000 is included or not?
Yes.
So how can, where's the error in this court saying you didn't have an agreement?
Here's what happened. The $5,000 was paid before any lawsuit was filed.
Understood.
Okay, now we have a lawsuit that's a breach of contract lawsuit saying you owe us money.
Right.
And the $5,000 was, here, you can have it. You never have to pay us this back. If you ultimately recover less money from a jury, you get to keep the $5,000. So the $5,000 has been paid. The lawsuit is now over everything in addition to that $5,000 that my client can try to recover.
I understand that you've got the view that the $20,000 is in addition to the $5,000. My question to you is why should this court reconsider its decision saying, in essence, the parties didn't have a meeting of the minds? You thought it was 25. They thought it was 20, 15 plus 5. You're back to square zero and do what you want.
Because that decision by the court would necessarily means that the court is assuming that there's a mutual mistake of fact as opposed to a unilateral mistake of fact.
Well, isn't there a mutual mistake of fact?
No, there's not.
Why not?
There's not a mutual mistake of fact. There's a unilateral mistake of fact, and this is why not. It goes to the Feldman case, which is identical to what happened here, where the District Court of Appeal in Florida, with State Farm, with this very same letter, with this very same situation, but for the offer of judgment issue, determined that where the parties negotiated a settlement for $75,000, and then after the fact, State Farm came in and said, but wait a minute, we already paid 40, so we only have to pay you 35 now. The court looked at that and said that was State Farm's unilateral mistake of fact when they negotiated a $75,000 settlement. They have the same letter in the case, but they negotiated a $75,000 settlement. So on its face, it was a $75,000 settlement. On its face, the offer of judgment in this case was a $20,000 and $1 settlement. So it's the identical situation that the court in Florida dealt with, and the court in Florida said that's a unilateral mistake of fact on the part of State Farm when they offered 75 when they meant to offer 35. That's what they did here. They offered 20 when they meant to offer 15, and when they offered 20, I, as the objectively reasonable person on the other end of that offer, say, okay, they're offering 20. So 20 is 20. When they meant 15, that's their unilateral mistake of fact.
I have a distinct impression, false as it may be, that we're being asked to serve as a finder of fact here about what the parties did and what a reasonably prudent person would interpret those actions to mean in regard to the settlement of this case. And I thought that the original opinion, in effect, if you'll excuse the colloquialism, gave you a do-over. Put you where you were before, where you could renegotiate or you could try the case, and that would resolve it. Why are we here?
We're here because we don't want a do-over. That's not what we want, and it's not what the other side wants. I think both sides want a decision one way or the other.
Did you get one from the trial court?
We did. Yeah, we did.
Where did they err? Where did the trial judge err?
The trial judge erred in not determining that this was a unilateral mistake of fact and an objective contract in my client's favor for $20,001 in new money. And what we're asking, and if the review that this court is supposed to exercise is a de novo review of what the Superior Court did, what we're asking essentially the court to do is to look at it in place of the Superior Court and look at it given what the Superior Court was given to look at and make a determination as to whether or not we're right or we're wrong. So that's what we're here for. And frankly, at this point, because even though this is not, well, I guess it is a matter of record, it's not a matter of the record below, but it's a matter of record in terms of the of what State Farm told this court in its motion for re-argument, was that they sent us a check, and we negotiated the check. So this dispute now at this point is over whether or not they owe us another $5,000. So what I think both sides want from the court is a decision as to whether they do or they don't.
But is it our job to give you that decision?
Well, we respectfully think it is, because our position is that what happened below was legally wrong.
Okay. How did the trial court get it wrong?
The trial court got it wrong by failing to acknowledge that this was under an objective test. There was a contract to settle the case for $20,001 in new money, and the unilateral mistake of State Farm in offering $20,000 when it meant to offer $15,000 does not void that contract. So that contract is valid, and it should be enforced.
Your interpretation of the $5,000 credit, in quotes, is that it only applied to an eventual finding by a jury or a judge trying the case without a jury, toward a verdict, not
correct,
toward any money offered toward a settlement.
Correct.
Didn't the trial judge resolve that in favor of no, it was a credit either way?
The trial judge did, yeah. And the trial judge made the comment at the hearing that he didn't think it mattered whether it took the form of a judgment or whether it was a settlement.
Is that a finding of fact or a finding of law?
That's a legal finding, I believe.
Well, doesn't it involve the intent of the parties?
Well, I think, again, you have to look, if we're going to evaluate whether or not a contract was formed and what the terms of it were, and we look at it from an objective standpoint, we're not looking so much at the intent of the parties as to what the what objectively appeared to be the settlement amount. And then you get to the next step, which is, well, why was there a dispute, and was it a mutual or a unilateral mistake?
How can a contract interpretation be anything other than the determination of the intent of the parties? That's what it's all about, isn't it?
Well, but the court still has to look at whether or not the court derives the intent of the parties from the objective evidence in the case. And if the subjective intent is different than what the objective intent appears to be, that the objective intent analysis is what
controls.
Well,
that assumes no
controls.
Ambiguity. That assumes that the contract's clear on its face, unambiguous, therefore it stands for what it says.
Which, in the contract in this case, is the offer of judgment, which says what it says. We offer to have judgment entered against us for $20,001, and my email saying, we accept it, send me the check. On its face, that is not. It's our position that that's not ambiguous. That's completely clear and unambiguous on its face. The ambiguity only comes in when you talk about their subjective intent of thinking that somehow this only means $15,000.
Well, the ambiguity comes in, doesn't it, when you determine what the credit means. Does it mean a credit against a verdict or a credit against any amount offered in settlement?
Well, I'm not sure how it can be. I'm not sure how even that can be ambiguous given the language of the offer of judgment, because the language of the offer of judgment says we're not even conceding that you've had any damages, that you've sustained any damages, and yet the language of the credit says this will be credited against any final determination of damages. So nobody's finally determined damages in the case. The parties have settled it.
As a legal matter, isn't the offer of judgment, once it's accepted and entered under Rule 68 is indistinguishable from a jury verdict that is entered as a judgment. And if that is so, why isn't there a credit against both on the facts of this case?
I see that my time is up.
Please answer my question.
Thank you. It's distinguishable in this way. The purpose of the Rule 68 offer of judgment is to act as a settlement mechanism. That's what it is. That's what the case law has said it is. That's what the purpose of it is. So in the usual situation, the offer of judgment is never even filed until after there's a jury verdict. And the only reason why it's filed is to create a record at that point so that a cost motion can be filed. The only other, and yet the order does, or the rule does say that they can be, that the offer of judgment and acceptance can be filed at any time. I'm aware of that. And so it could be filed before a verdict, but it typically isn't because it doesn't need to be. And even if it were to be filed before a verdict, the only possible use that I can see of doing that would be if the defendant, for whatever reason, was reneging on paying the money. And so the plaintiff's lawyer decides, well, they offered to allow judgment against them. Now they won't pay, so I've got to file the judgment and go collect on it.
I recognize you're out of time, including your rebuttal time, but do you have empirical data to suggest that an offer of judgment is filed most often after there's a jury verdict?
Well, I only have my own personal experience.
The reason I thought the purpose of the offer of judgment was to spur settlement.
But it's not.
That it was sure money, and it's encouraged in order to obviate the need for trial.
But it's not filed, Your Honor. It's not filed with the court. In fact, you're not supposed to file it with the court until it's accepted. So what happens is the other side sends it.
We're talking about two different things, aren't we? An offer of judgment's different than this notice of settlement.
No. I think we're talking about the same thing. The offer of judgment, if I'm defending a case and I want to notify the other side that I'm giving them an offer of judgment, I serve it on them. I don't file it with the court.
Okay.
It doesn't get filed with the court until it's accepted, and then either side at that point, once there's an acceptance, is free to file it with the court if they so desire.
Okay, so when you're talking about after the verdict, you're talking about actually filing it with the court, not sending it to the other side.
Right. I'm talking about a situation where after the offer of judgment is filed for $10,000, the jury verdict comes in at $5,000. Defense lawyer will then file that offer of judgment unaccepted after the verdict to with the court to, in support of its motion for costs.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Susan Haskey on behalf of Appellee State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. Members of the court, the question before you today is whether an acceptance of an offer of judgment is a final determination of damages, which would permit State Farm in this case to take the credit of $5,000. And we believe that the Superior Court correctly determined that holding and that the offer of judgment in this matter was clear, was unambiguous, and I think both parties actually agree upon that, although obviously we agree that the circumstances surrounding the amount of that award is different. But the Superior Court felt that it was clear and unambiguous. They felt it was a final determination of damages and felt that because it was a final determination of damages under the prior letter sent by State Farm with the advancement of the $5,000, State Farm was permitted to take a credit against that final determination of damages. Mr. Landon and I agree in actually quite a few areas. We both believe that there was a contract that was entered into. We agree to the terms of that contract.
So
it
would be fair to say you reject the do-over concept in the same way he does?
I do. I think the dispute here is whether or not there was a contract, and I think we all agree that there was a contract, and then what are the terms of the contract, where the disagreement lies. The problem here, I feel where Mr. Landon and I differ, is I do not believe that we get to that prior negotiating because it's a clear and unambiguous contract. The offer of judgment is clear. It says, we permit plaintiff to enter judgment against State Farm in the amount of $20,001. That's clear. No dispute there. When a judgment is accepted, an offer of judgment, the judgment is entered in the amount of $20,001. There's a final determination of damages at that point. Pursuant to the prior letter, the final determination of damages, there's a credit of $5,000.
State Farm is entitled. That's where the dispute is.
And that is where the dispute is. But the arguments made by the parties aren't necessarily that the contract for the advancement, which I think is where you guys are focusing on, is the contract for the advancement.
What?
The focus of the court is the contract for the advancement, that $5,000 advancement. I don't think it's a contract. It's these terms. If you want to deposit this check for $5,000, you're not precluded from going in an attempt to getting more. But if there's a final determination of damages, that final determination is done by $5,000.
Is that what the cover letter said?
That is what the cover. It says the remaining coverage will be reduced by the amount of this payment, and the amount will be credited against, quote, any final determination of damages.
Why wasn't, does the record reflect why there wasn't a similar cover letter with the offer of judgment? I mean, it seems that State Farm could have eliminated all of this ambiguity, if there is one, by just simply being clear.
Your Honor, the contracts that were the negotiations that were done through the mediator, I did say those exact same words. They are part of the record, and it was specifically said to the mediator that State Farm had $20,000 to get it done. Plaintiff had already received $15,000 from the tortfeasor, had already received $5,000 from State Farm, so I have an additional $15,000 to offer. So that was done as part of the negotiation processes. Could the offer of judgment specifically said $15,001 of new money? Yes. Could it have said $20,000 and $1 plus the credit for $5,000? It could. But the offer of judgment at that point was being entered for the purposes of the rule, that the cost sharing, that the shifting of the costs. If State Farm had entered that offer of judgment or made an offer of judgment for something less than they would have valued the whole case, I could see a situation with if I'd entered it for $15,001 and the jury verdict came back at $17,000, well, State Farm had valued this case at $20,000. So where does the cost shifting occur? And then you're causing the court to step into the parties and try to adjust everything. Where it's clear that State Farm had evaluated this case and put a value on this case of $20,001, and therefore that's what the offer of judgment was for.
Well, you acknowledge that all of this issue would have been resolved if the offer of judgment said $20,000 less the $5,000 advanced or something to that effect, right?
I do acknowledge it, just like it would have been acknowledged if there was any dispute or any concerns had plaintiff's counsel picked up the phone and said, I just want to be clear, this is $20,000
new money
or is it not? Because
but
my...
Let me interrupt.
Sure.
What I'm getting at is that we've got two parties who have different views as to what's going on here, right?
Correct.
And a document that's filed that could be interpreted either of two ways, even if the document on its face is unambiguous, in light of the prior payment, that seemingly unambiguous document takes on an ambiguity, correct?
I don't think it's very ambiguous. I think the docketed entry says, enter judgment against State Farm in the amount of $20,001. If a judgment is entered against State Farm in the amount of $20,001, that's a final determination of damages.
Okay.
If there's a final determination of damages, then we get the credit of $5,000.
I understand your argument. All I'm suggesting and asking you is that since you concede, as I think you must, that this whole problem could have been avoided with a little bit more clarity in the language, why shouldn't the insurance company bear the burden of having filed a document that was not as explicit as it could have been?
Because I think it was explicit. I mean, I think it was clear. There's two problems going on here. There was conversations being done with the mediator. I can only relay what I relayed to the mediator. I do not know what the mediator in turn relayed to plaintiff's counsel, and I can only tell you what the scope of my conversations were with the mediator and to plaintiff's counsel. During that time period, we had taken the credit. It was clear that we were looking at a credit of $5,000. I specifically have disputed and disputed on the pleadings that I've ever increased my offer to $20,001 or $20,000 in new money. My conversation with Mr. Landon just reaffirmed what I had previously offered through the mediator. I had no additional monies, and I made the same offer.
Again, you're explaining why your interpretation is correct. And I'm asking you why, in light of the fact that there are disputes as to which interpretation is correct, and there is a basis for a finding of ambiguity in light of the fact that there's no specific reference to the prior payment, in those circumstances, the insurer pays.
Because if that's the way this court is looking at the case, then there is no meeting of the minds as to the value, and then we are placed back to square one. The parties
which is what we did the first time.
Well, Your Honor, the difference, I think, between the first decision and what we are looking for here, the first decision was really focused on the entering of the judgment, and I think the court needs to focus a little bit on what's the role of an acceptance of an offer of judgment. Does that have any teeth? A lot of times these parties accept offers of judgments and they're not filed with the court as a matter of course immediately after. But what type of teeth does that have? What binding effect does that have if somebody accepts an offer of judgment? Mr. Landon brought up the case of sometime down the line the plaintiff might need to file that offer of judgment with the court in order to negotiate on that judgment, execute on that judgment, force a settlement from the plaintiff's standpoint. We agree from the standpoint of you need to have some teeth in the acceptance of the offer of judgment. And if any party at some time later can say, well, we dispute the acceptance of the offer of judgment, the offer of judgment is not clear on its fact, then the acceptance of the offer of judgment really has no binding effect.
Well, I understand that. My problem was, on the facts of this case, when the motion to enforce acceptance of offer of judgment was filed, did you or did you not understand there was a disagreement about the terms of the offer of judgment?
And, Your Honor, I clearly did. And in hindsight, it would have been much more prudent for me to have filed a letter with the court telling the court not to enter judgment. But that was never the focus, quite honestly, of any of my arguments. I was never taking the argument, there's a judgment entered. My argument has always been, there's an acceptance of an offer of judgment. That has the same effect as a binding contract.
Okay, well, consider when we wrote the first opinion. Think Shakespeare, think I'm the Duke of Verona. A plague on both your houses was my view. Why is it my problem? Take the old army phrase. Lack of preparation on your part does not constitute an emergency on my part. I sent it back in my own mind when I voted to do what we did for the purpose of having you all redo it and get it worked out without us having to be involved, because it is not our problem. It's a problem of both you're making.
And I understand.
So why are we here?
Because quite honestly, Your Honor, the parties are hopeful that the court will determine whether or not another $5,000 is owed and whether or not under these circumstances there's a credit.
In effect, not to be trite, but you because of lack of preparation on both your parts, it does constitute an emergency on our part, and we're to divert ourselves from what we would rather be doing and settle the squabble.
Your Honor, I don't think it constitutes an emergency, and I just think there's obviously a dispute between the parties, and just like any contractual dispute, we're asking the court to resolve that when there's a contract dispute. I think any contract can always be written clearer. I think every contract before this court, if there's any subject...
Perhaps you're missing the point of the Chief Justice's comments, which is that if you have a contract, then yes, there are disputes frequently about exactly what it means and so forth. But you don't have a contract, at least in one way of looking at things, because there was never a meeting of the minds as to how much money was going to change hands. So this court says, no, you don't try and figure out what the right answer is, because there is no right answer here. We've got two parties who were operating on different assumptions, and they can start over again. There is no contract. Why is that not a valid result?
Because both parties, I believe, in this case, arguing that there is a contract.
Well, and frequently both parties argue that a contract is unambiguous, but one party says it means what I say, the other party says it means something else. And obviously, you can't both be right if it's unambiguous. It only means one thing.
What?
Well, the fact that both of you think you have a contract doesn't mean you have a stipulation to that effect, and the court has to now sit down and resolve how much it's for.
Well, Your Honor, I think not only do the parties agree that they have the contract terms. And the question only comes down to, assuming there is a contract, assuming the contract terms is $20,001, does State Farm get a credit, or do they not get a credit? That's really the dispute here.
So the dispute boils down to whether that original exchange of correspondence and conversation about the $5,000 credit was intended to be against whatever final amount was resolved to be the value of the case, or it was a credit only against a verdict by a jury or a judge after trial. Is that fair?
That's Mr. Landon's position. I think a final determination of damages obviously is a little bit different than a trier of fact determining the final amount of damages.
Well, you agree with what I just said. It's just what constitutes, for the purpose of the credit, a final determination of damages. Is it settlement,
yes,
or is it only a verdict?
Right.
Isn't that the dispute?
I think that might be the dispute. Is that
now? How do you have a contract if that's the dispute?
I think it's clear that the final determination of damages is not ambiguous. What's a final determination of damages if it's not the time when the damages are finally resolved? When are damages finally resolved at any point in the case? Could be a jury trial.
When you filed a piece of paper saying the final determination of damages was $20,000, Mr. Landon believed the final determination of damages was $25,001, right?
Right, but that's not ambiguous on the face of the document itself. The document itself says $20,001. Looking at it from a reasonable standpoint, from a reasonable person standard, $20,001 is what is going to be entered against State Farm. State Farm had previously advanced $5,000. If you're looking, this was just a creditor dispute, and State Farm said, here's the $5,000 I paid you, here's the $15,001, your judgment is $20,000, they add up.
All right, so if I understand you correctly, your position is as straightforward and as clear as, when we filed the offer of judgment for $20,001, that was our statement of the final determination of damages. When Mr. Landon said, I accept, even if he had in the back of his mind that he could keep the $5,000 and get a check for $20,000, it didn't matter because this final determination of damages was an all-inclusive $20,001.
That's correct.
The case is not more complicated than that.
That's correct.
Now, in Feldman, which is a Florida mm-hmm. case, this mm-hmm. same language, mm-hmm. State Farm lost, right?
Yep, and that was an entirely different case, Your Honor.
Well, just as a matter of courtesy, mm-hmm, and yeah, really doesn't make it at this level of practice.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So my follow-up question is, notwithstanding that case, the language was used again in this case.
That case was entirely different, Your Honor. That was a case where an agreement was entered during mediation process.
Does the record reflect this is some State Farm form that is generated from somewhere?
It does. It is a form that is used quite often when State Farm does forward these advancements. Correct.
Even when it's been litigated against it that it didn't cut it?
Because it wasn't the form that was the issue. Previously, there was no finding in the Feldman case that the final determination of damages was in a mediation. At that case, what had happened, the parties went to mediation. The parties mediated this case without any discussion of a $40,000 prior advancement by State Farm. That was never brought out at all during the mediation process. The agreement that the parties entered into was State Farm will pay plaintiff $75,000. That
now,
case.
How do we construe this document? Should it be construed against State Farm? Should it be liberally construed? What's the rule of construction?
I believe it's going to be a rule of construction that will be construed against State Farm as the drafter of the document and as the more sophisticated party.
With that construction, mm-hmm. why don't you lose?
I think because, Your Honor, going back to that Feldman case, the Feldman case looked at the discussions between the parties at mediation, never looked at that $40,000 prior credit. Looking at the clear language that was entered into by the parties, it said State Farm will play plaintiff $75,000. The court said, we're not looking at anything extrinsic. We're looking to the document itself. That document is clear, that document is concise, and it's unambiguous. State Farm is to pay $75,000 with the party's subjective intent. Whatever happened before him is not relevant. That was the holding in Feldman. Feldman never got to whether or not that $75,000 was a final determination of damages. Feldman got to the point that based upon the party's conduct at mediation and the fact that State Farm agreed to pay $75,000, that it was a unilateral mistake on State Farm's part if they did not take credit at that mediation for the $40,000 previously paid. That's not what happened here. In fact, Feldman, to some extent, helps us because the unilateral mistake, if any, is made upon plaintiffs because we had taken the credit from the beginning. My email to Ms. Seville could not have been any clearer than to specify what we valued the case at based upon what the tortfeasor paid out, the credit that we were taking, and what the value what we were putting on the case.
Do you really believe that communications between State Farm and counsel in cases of this kind mean that the language of State Farm's communication is to be construed against them? Isn't that rule to deal with consumers?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't really understand where you're getting with that question.
Well, this concept of construing the cover letter with the $5,000 credit against State Farm when it's sent to counsel and it's part of an ongoing mediation and discussion between counsel, why would the language be construed against State Farm under those circumstances?
That's not sent to counsel, Your Honor. That's a cover letter that's sent to the plaintiff with the check for the advancement of $5,000.
But plaintiffs represented.
Sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't.
In this case, they were.
I believe they were, but they were not by Mr. Landon at that time. That's correct. The letter is sent with the understanding that there's a final determination of damages.
I just
want
to understand State Farm's position mm-hmm. on when the correspondence would be construed against them.
I think when it's ambiguous, it can be construed against them as the drafter of the document.
That. I get that.
I just don't feel that it's ambiguous in this in this instance. Just one final point. The court had asked at one point during the prior decision that was entered that this case would have been very different had the judgment have been entered shortly after the parties had accepted that. And I just would submit to the court that it wouldn't have been any different no matter what had happened and when that offer of judgment was actually filed with the court. We would have still been here today because the parties knew at that time through motion practice that the parties were going to have to resolve the amount of the judgment.
All right. Thank you very
much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Right.